Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. We all know about the recent death of a young man with severe autism living in a residential home. Well, this brought up many important issues. Brian Nevin's death in a hot van was a completely avoidable tragedy, but it raises questions about the safety and security of those living in residential facilities. It also raises questions about what the alternatives are, if any. People with intellectual disabilities are in many ways one of the most invisible groups in this country, especially as they get older. Services dwindle, options are limited. On today's show, we'll discuss with people what people with intellectual disabilities need so they can live the best life possible. We'll also talk about what their families should realistically want for them and what their legal options are. Later in the show, we'll be joined by Dr. Susan Epstein and Josh Kirschenbaum. Epstein works in autism research, and her 20-year-old daughter lives in a residential treatment facility. Josh Kirschenbaum is a lawyer specializing in special needs with Frankel and Kirschenbaum. We'll also hear in just a few minutes from Anna Hundley. She's past president of the National Association of Residential Providers for Adults with Autism. She's going to discuss the challenges providers face. But first, what do we even mean when we use these words like intellectual disabilities? And what should services, treatment, and research look like from a medical perspective?
Dr. Levitas, what are intellectual disabilities?
At this point, intellectual disabilities is more of a legal term than a medical term. It refers to any form of cognitive disability that is not a dementia. And it encompasses the categories that are still in medical terminology called mental retardation, although that phrase will probably be updated, autism spectrum disorders. It also includes people with acquired brain injuries or traumatic brain injuries if the injury is acquired before a certain age. In New Jersey, it's 16.
So we're really talking about very, very different people in one group.
A very, very wide variety of needs and expectations, yes.
And functioning also ranges then?
The functioning, if we just look at IQ, which is a very, very rough estimate of cognitive functioning, then we're talking about, and again, this is a legal definition, below IQ 70. And there's the mild range of disability, which ranges from about IQ 55 to 70, the moderate range from about 35 to 50, the severe range from 20 to 35, and the profound range, which is below IQ 20. The needs of someone with an IQ of 20 who lacks language entirely are completely different from the needs of someone who's functioning in the mild range of cognitive disability with an IQ of 65.
What are some other factors that complicate caring for people with intellectual disabilities, be it behavioral issues or medical issues?
Well, again, a wide range of medical issues. One of the causes of intellectual disabilities are genetic syndromes, which come with a huge range of cardiac, renal, that is kidney, and gastrointestinal complications, metabolic disorders of various kinds that all need medical attention. There's a particular pattern of behavioral and psychiatric problems that come with these syndromes. Adults with Down syndrome, for example, are very prone to anxiety disorders of various kinds, obsessive-compulsive disorder, panic disorder. People with Fragile X syndrome are very prone to anxiety disorders and ADHD. So there's this huge range of individual behavioral abilities and disabilities.
What do services look like? What is the goal, the overarching goal of the services people with intellectual disabilities receive?
The overarching goal of services, as I understand it anyway, is to help people become as independent and as functional and as able to participate in the wider society as their pattern of deficits and abilities allows them to be. Having said that, you know, I think it's evident that this could not possibly be a one-size-fits-all system. Unfortunately, however, that is the way services are delivered. People are brought into a system that's designed to fit the needs, some of the needs that perhaps they all share, but the individualized needs are often falling by the wayside.
Are we looking at all into reversing intellectual disabilities, improving people's functioning overall?
Well, you know, if you had asked me that question a month ago, I would have poo-pooed it. I would have said, yes, people are looking, but there's no evidence that such a thing could be. But, in fact, just weeks ago at the National Fragile X Foundation conference in Detroit, we all were astonished to see videotapes of mice with Fragile X syndrome who had the silenced gene turned on again by a molecular technique that's in publication, and these mice performing some cognitive tasks at the same level as their normal lab mouse buddies. Now, having said that, we'll have to add a couple of caveats. We don't know if those effects can be reproduced in humans. We're a very long way from that. And then, of course, there are the intellectual disabilities that don't have a known cause yet, or have complex causes of interacting genetic factors that we don't understand and may not for quite some time to come.
When we think about services, oftentimes we think along the lines of early intervention, school support, all of those things. How important are ongoing services for adults to keep the intellectual stimulation, all of those things going, and are they available? Is that being done?
Well, in my opinion, they are all important. I think the problem comes from a focus on early intervention and services and the belief, the wish, I suppose, that those services are going to reverse the worst effects of intellectual disability, that those services are going to leave people in adulthood able to cope, and that they will vanish into the life of the general society. What's true for someone with mild intellectual disability is not going to be true for someone with profound intellectual disability or severe intellectual disability. The other issue is that we've had for a long time an emphasis on trying to produce normal-looking behavior. And what we've done is we've sort of taught people how to behave, but what we've really taught them is, listen to us, we'll tell you how to behave. And we've created, unwittingly, I think, a generation of people with intellectual disabilities who are socialized to being told what to do. Once they're told what to do, they know how to do it. But what we really need in normal life is initiative and ability to decide what to do on our own. An example of this is sort of built into our services. North Princeton Developmental Center in New Jersey was closed in 1995 over the course of a very short period of time. It was closed and people were sent out to group homes, one of which is located a quarter of a mile from my home. Now, North Princeton Developmental Center was on a huge tract of land. People had three-wheel bicycles. They had the run of the place. Five of those individuals were moved to a group home within a quarter of a mile of my home, which is also, both of those places, my home and this group home, are a quarter of a mile from a beautiful little lake and park. And in the 15 years since 1995, I have yet to see any member of that group home down at that lake, you know, walking around, just sitting under a tree, or feeding the ducks. So people who went from an institutional setting, which is supposed to be, in theory, synonymous with restrictions on your life, and in fact had the run of a gigantic rural campus, are now pretty much confined to a group home in a suburban setting, you know, stuck in, you know, watching TV or going to the mall when everybody goes, you know, as opposed to when they feel like going. And the paradox is constantly with me.
That was Dr. Andrew Levitas. He's a professor of psychiatry. He works with people with intellectual disabilities at the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Medicine and Dentistry here in New Jersey. He was speaking with WHYY's behavioral health reporter, Mike and Scott. We're talking about people with intellectual disabilities on today's show, specifically We're going to be talking about residential treatment. What's available? How do we find what's available? What are the goals? And, of course, how do we pay for it? Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Give us a call if you are someone with an intellectual disability or you know or love someone with one, and we'd like to hear about what treatment you're receiving, how it's working for you, how it's not working for you, and what you feel you need. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, now we're going to talk a bit about residential services, what they do and don't provide, and what the goals are. We're going to be chatting with Anna Hundley, who's joining us by phone from her office in Texas. She's past president of the National Association of Residential Providers for Adults with Autism. Anna, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I guess the first question I have for you is a residential provider. What is the goal? You know, we had this disaster here in Philadelphia where a young man with autism died after he was left accidentally alone in a car that overheated. So obviously the primary goal has to be safety, but what's the overarching goal for residential treatment facilities?
Well, the overarching goal for residential treatment is like what your previous guest said, one size does not fit all. Residential treatment must be tailored to the unique needs of the individual. And we must have a well-trained, quality staff to provide the services. Unfortunately, the funding rates that we receive for adult services makes having that quality staff sometimes a difficult issue.
When we spoke to you before the show, Anna, last week, you said something that was shocking to me. I want to make sure that we got it right. You said you receive more at your facility. You receive more for 1 hour of speech therapy for a child than you do for 24 hours of residential services for an adult.
You heard that correctly.
That's shocking.
You heard that very correctly. And again, it's not that I want to take anything away, because we provide services and early intervention services for children. And our hope is, like your previous speaker said, that if we intervene early and we give appropriate treatment, then less services will be needed in the adult part of the person's life. But that's not always the case. And we're not receiving appropriate reimbursement for providing services for adults.
Okay,
and
so
then we have. Go ahead.
I want to know then how you do what you said you needed to do in my first question, that you have to provide individualized treatment with highly skilled staff. How do you do that with such meager reimbursement rates?
Well, it's not easy, I can tell you that, and we struggle every day. But what we have done here at the Autism Treatment Center, we've been around for 33 years. I've been here for 28 years, and I have many other senior staff that have been here that long. We started approximately 20 years ago. We realized we were not going to get the kinds of reimbursement that we needed to provide the services. So we're a nonprofit agency, so we raise. I have a staff that does nothing but look for grants and raises, and we raise money privately. And luckily now in Dallas, yes, it's hard with the economy like it is, but we can still raise private funds to help support the program. We could not make ends meet unless we did that.
Can I ask you your average salary for staff who are working directly with your residents there?
Probably the average salary for staff is around $35,000 for the direct care staff.
And what kind of training do they get?
Well, we provide our on training. We have a week of classroom training, and then we have 3 months of supervised hands-on training. And we, you know, that's sometimes that's not enough. And we are constantly, when we have good supervisors and when we see that a staff is not getting it and doesn't know what they do, we try to retrain, but then sometimes we can't retrain. Sometimes it's just not a good job match for the person.
Tell us, in your opinion, Anna, people with intellectual disabilities are living longer. What are your thoughts about the implications for the future, for future
students? Well, they are living longer. I have people in the program that are in their 60s. And the oldest gentleman that we have right now is 65. And he has, of course, he's beginning to have other health issues, just normal health issues, like I had to have a hip replaced. And they have to have many kinds of medical treatment like that. But the largest issue that is happening is that these people that are 60 and 65, just like I'm 67, my parents are no longer living. His parents are no longer living. And then that becomes a huge issue. Then who is going to be the guardian for this individual? Is it going to be one of his brothers or sisters or another family member? And if this happens with an adult that is living at home with their parents, and then the parents die, then there's a huge, huge hole and a huge gap in that services. I don't know if you saw yesterday in the New York Times, there was an excellent article, and it was called My Brother's Keeper, and it was by, Lorna Wyckoff. Now, the individual did not have autism, but they had a serious intellectual disability, and he had lived with his mother all of his life, and then the mother died, and then it became his sister's responsibility of helping take care of him and trying to provide an appropriate lifestyle and living for him, and the struggles that she went through trying to do that, and the struggles that she is going through every day. And those are some of the things and some of the issues that are going to be facing individuals that have older children.
Well, my wish, Anna, those are some of the issues that service providers and consumers are going to be facing. My great wish is those are issues that hopefully we as a country will also face and pay proper attention to those who need it. Anna, I know you are on a tight time deadline. We promised to get you out of here by 30 minutes after the hour. And we shall. So I want to thank you so much for your time and thank you for the work you do.
Thank you, and I really appreciate what you're doing to bring this issue to the public.
Thank you, Anna. Anna Hundley is past president of the National Association of Residential Providers for Adults with Autism. We're going to take a very short break now, and when we come back, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Susan Epstein, who works in autism research, and her 20-year-old daughter lives in a residential facility. We're also going to be joined with Josh Kirschenbaum. He's a lawyer who specializes in special needs with Frankel and Kirschenbaum. And because he's a lawyer, I'm confident he's going to tell us how to resolve all these problems. We're talking about residential treatment facilities, how they work, what they mean, and how they can be improved. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
After the flower power rock of the 60s, T-Rex and their album Electric Warrior ushered in a new era of glam rock.
the time was absolutely right for a change. People were bored with the bearded rock stars and they wanted some nice, clean-shaven, pretty boys. And we had the right music and the right look.
That's Electric Warrior producer Tony Visconti. Tune in for our classic album dissection of T-Rex's glam rock masterpiece this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, NPR's Scott Simon tells us about adopting his daughters from China.
There's no Hallmark card moment when your little girl is put into your arms under the circumstances, because the only world they've known is behind them.
It's the subject of his new memoir. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about people with intellectual disabilities. Well, not just people, their families and their providers and residential treatment and what that looks like, what it can look like. Our number is 888-477-9499. With me in the studio here is Dr. Susan Epstein. She's a researcher with the Center for Autism Research here at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Josh Kirschenbaum is a lawyer representing special needs with Frankel and Kirschenbaum. Josh, let's start with you. We've covered a lot of territory already, but let's start at the beginning. How does one determine their child has intellectual disabilities? And we heard in the beginning of the interview IQ tests, and that's a number I think. The more we mature in that field, the less we know about what that number
absolutely
really measures. But I'm wondering what happens, what do parents see, and what do they do?
Well, I think that it starts out for many people when their child is very young. And for many parents, it's when their child is even an infant, and they just have a feeling that something's different. Something is not the same about my child as the other children their age. For some parents, they find out early from their doctors that the child isn't developing as expected. And, you know, they find out when the child is quite young. But for others, depending on the type of disability that we're talking about, it doesn't become clear until perhaps the child is older and problems are developing with speech and communication, when the child's in school, and it starts to become clear that there are some learning issues. So it really depends on the child and on the particular issues that they're developing.
And what services, what's a parent to do when you have a child who's an infant or a toddler or a two-year-old? Who do you call?
Well, one of the first things, here in Pennsylvania and in other states as well, we have what's called an early intervention system. And for children who are in the 0 to 3 range, there are services available through the counties and through the state, particularly geared towards helping young children, infants and toddlers, who have disabilities of various kinds, get the kind of supports they need. And that can include everything from speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, and even in Pennsylvania, and I think this is extremely important for all listeners who have or suspect that they have a child with a disability, there's health insurance available in Pennsylvania through the Medicaid system for children with severe disabilities. And that health insurance is often the key to accessing the services that the families need.
Severe disabilities. So I got to ask you a lawyer question. So what does that mean?
Well, that's a good question. And of course, that can be the subject of some debate. But for example, autism is by definition considered, anything on the autism spectrum disorder is by definition considered a severe disability. And the actual determination of whether a child has a severe disability for the purposes of Medicaid is determined based on Social Security standards and guidelines. And it's not something that's easy for a parent to necessarily work out, but there are free resources available to help you figure that out.
Susan.
I'm sitting over here kind of like twitching because in actuality, I'm a psychologist at the Center for Autism Research, and I do the actual kinds of assessments that you're talking about in terms of determining whether a child has autism and whether a child has an intellectual disability. So one thing that I wanted to add to what's already been said is that it's not enough for a child to have a low IQ, a low level of cognitive functioning. It's also important that there are measures and assessments of what we call the child's adaptive functioning, meaning that what they're actually able to do on a day-to-day basis also must be seen as being below the norm for their age. Sometimes we get children and adults who have a really a lot of discrepancy between what they can do in different areas of function, and their overall IQ score might be a little bit deceptive. But so what you're looking for overall is a low level of cognitive ability paired with a low level of adaptive functioning.
Tell us your story when you first started noticing something with your daughter.
I have a unique story. At the time when my daughter was a baby, she's a fraternal twin, and her fraternal twin sister started life headed right towards where she is now, which is an aspiring actress and singer. When she was a baby, she would sparkle at you from the changing table. And my other daughter was quiet and passive and very beautiful, but just quiet and passive. I also had a sister living in Michigan who was a teacher for children with autism for 25, 30 years. So around the time that my daughter got to be, I don't know, maybe 18 months old, and her sister was surpassing her in many ways, and I was saying to myself, don't compare them, don't compare them, don't compare them. I was already a mental health professional at the time, and I had dinner with some friends whose son had just been diagnosed with autism. And when I described what was going on with her, the mother said, well, do you think she needs to be evaluated? And I said, no, what are you talking about? She's fine. But I went home that night, and I knew. I knew. And I called up my sister, and I said, you know, Barbara, she's twiddling the knobs on the furniture. She's walking on her toes. She's not talking. And my sister said, it's impossible. It can't be. But it was. So yeah. She was young. She was below two.
Would you mind fast-forwarding now for a few years to school?
Mm-hmm.
She never did speak. She wasn't speaking. Her autism is pretty severe. So tell us what her autism looked like when she went to school and what happened in school. We'll talk a little bit about IEPs, too.
Right. Well, she does have language, but she doesn't have functional language. So, for example, she knows the words to 100 songs. And she has certain little scripted phrases that she can use. But she can't say, my stomach hurts. She can't say, that kid hit me. She can't formulate anything spontaneous. She was one of those children that people kept saying, she's going to do great. She's going to do great. But it didn't turn out that way. Her language is probably at about the same place that it was once she got to be maybe 6 years old. And from preschool through the time she was 12, she was at home with us in a specialized autism program that combined behavioral interventions with other kinds of interventions and a lot of speech therapy. And the story of how we came to decide on residential treatment is another big one, and I won't get into that now unless you want me to.
No, we're going to get to that in a minute. I kind of want to track this through. Josh, what is a school's responsibility?
Schools have a responsibility under federal law and state law to provide every child with a disability a free and appropriate public education if the child meets the eligibility requirements for the statute. And basically, it's quite straightforward. There are a list of disabilities under federal law that qualify you as a person with disabilities under the statute. And the statute I'm referring to is the Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act, or IDEA, as it's commonly called. And the child has to need special education and related services. The child has to need modifications to the curriculum and to the school programming in order to be able to make progress in school. And certainly for a child with severe autism, they would qualify for services under that. And once the child qualifies, the school has a responsibility to provide that child with what's called a free and appropriate public education. And to translate that out of lawyerese, they are responsible for providing an education at no cost to the family that enables the child to make meaningful progress in school, to access the curriculum, to learn as close as appropriate to the way other kids are learning in school. And, you know, I think what can be very frustrating for many parents is that this doesn't mean that the school has the responsibility to enable that child to maximize his or her potential. But it does mean that they do have an obligation to provide programming to that child to enable that child to learn and to make progress in school in as much as appropriate with other kids who are typically developing. It's what we call in the field the least restrictive environment, to as much as appropriate enable that child to learn with other kids in school, kids who are typically developing.
So we know that schools now are in great financial problems, and I feel like I'm about to have the same conversation with you that I had with Anna Hundley, who runs a residential treatment facility who gets awful reimbursement. Schools are broke, and these services, to do them right, cost money.
It's true, and it is a terrible problem. It's a societal problem. But as I say to my clients, you can't let it be your problem. And I think that's really important, that parents are told in many stages along the way, from a school or from a, you know, a residential treatment facility or whomever is caring for their child, we can't afford. And these may all be true, but for the parent who's advocating for their child, they are often the only person in the whole world who is going to speak up for that child and who's going to fight for what that child needs. And they can't accept, and they shouldn't accept, those answers. If there needs to be more funding for schools in Pennsylvania or in any other state, that needs to happen. But at the frontline level, the parents can't accept that, should not accept that as a basis for denying the child the services that they need. They just have to fight for it. And the law doesn't permit the schools to use cost as an excuse. And I think that can be a big problem. But I just have to say to the parents who call me and who speak with me, you just can't take that as an answer. You have to know your child's rights. You have to be the voice, be the advocate for them.
What was your relationship with your child's school? Was it cooperative? Was it adversarial? Did you have to fight with them?
My relationship with where she was actually in school was good. My relationship with the school district, when I decided that I wanted a residential placement for her, was quite adversarial.
You wanted a residential placement while she was still in school?
She was in a special, not in her district school. She was in a program in New York that was called BOCES, which I believe is probably somewhat similar to intermediate units here. When she was 12, we began looking into residential treatment. And so again, the school that she was in, the staff, that was a good relationship. The relationship with the school district, that was not a good relationship.
The ones who were writing the checks for this, yeah.
Right.
We're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, we've got lots of callers on the line, and I do want to talk about residential facilities, what their struggles are, how you find them, and I want to talk about your relationship with a residential facility. I would imagine they parallel our relationship with our schools. We have to have good relationships with them, and we've got to keep our eye on them at all times. It's a complicated relationship. We're talking about residential treatment for people with intellectual disabilities. Our number is 888-477-9499. My guests are Josh Kirschenbaum and Susan Epstein. Kirschenbaum's a lawyer specializing in special needs. He's with Frankel and Kirschenbaum. Susan Epstein is a psychologist and works at the Center for Autism Research at Children's Hospital here in Philadelphia. She's also got a 20-year-old daughter who lives in a residential treatment facility. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
I like to be remembered that my being on this planet helped it to be greener than if I weren't here.
If you're over 50 and have embraced a new passion or direction in life, we want to hear your story. Stories of encore careers, new experiences, or creative civic involvement. Be a part of WHYY's Coming of Age series. Visit us at whyy.org/wider horizons.
Antoine Dodson made the local TV news when he fought off an attacker and saved his sister from sexual assault. Now he's a YouTube sensation with a song that both ridicules and pays him. Is this funny? And is the joke on him or on us?
We laugh at it all the time. We watch the videos and we listen to the song. But it doesn't change the fact that this was a serious event.
Antoine Dodson speaks for himself next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about people with intellectual disabilities and the care they need. My guests are Susan Epstein, who works in autism research at the Center for Autism Research at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. Josh Kirschenbaum is an attorney who specializes in special needs. He's with Frankel and Kirschenbaum. I want to get to how we decide about going to a residential facility, Susan. How did you make that decision? What was it like for you?
I was one of those people who thought it would never happen, ever, never in a million years happen. And when she was about 11, I believe, the school that she attended brought in a speaker from a residential facility in upstate New York. And it was a wonderful presentation, and we became very interested and went to see the school and loved the school, and through that accidental introduction began to think about how at her age this could be a very good thing for her that I would not have been willing to even think about until it was presented to me in that particular way. So we started out by pursuing this particular school, and it turned out that that wasn't possible, but that started my search for looking for a residential placement for her, because she was getting to adolescence and the level of consistency that she needed was growing, not diminishing, as she got older.
I'd like to hear from you. I think from you, Josh, how do you search? How do you begin searching for a residential facility that's appropriate for your child? And Susan, you know, you're an expert in the field, you know, and you know, I looked for services for my grandson, and I was floundering.
Yeah, it can be really overwhelming. Fortunately, we're living in the internet age, and I think that in this case, the internet can be a very valuable starting point for many people. However, I will also point out that oftentimes our decision about where to send our particular child is, you know, unfortunately driven by cost. It's driven by what can we afford? What does our insurance cover? And in Pennsylvania, if your child is receiving coverage through Medicaid and your private insurance, either you don't have any or it doesn't cover it, you may be at first limited to whatever places they happen to cover in the network. As at least a starting point for your discussion. And they will provide you with a list of places. And what I always tell my clients is, when you're provided with a list, the first thing you should remember is, it's just a starting point. While they will say, these are the only places that we will pay for, that is in fact not true. It is in fact the case that if none of those places is appropriate for your child, then the child has the right to have access to other facilities. But as a starting point, once you have a list of names, you can research those places online. You must visit any place that you are considering sending your child to. And if possible, speak to other families and parents who have folks there.
I don't know whose question this is. Susan, I don't know if you're an expert on residential facilities, but when you visit these places, what do you look for?
Do you want to take that one, Susan?
I'm trying to think of whether to answer that as myself now or as myself back when I was actually looking.
Now.
Okay.
We want an expert.
Okay. Well, the obvious things in terms of, is the place clean? Does it look like they have a lot of different activities and a lot of space and a lot of variety in what's going on? But one of the things that is the most important is to have your eye open for the way all levels of staff are interacting with the residents and with each other. Are they laughing? Are they smiling? Are they having fun? Are they angry? Are they overwhelmed? Are they yelling at their peers because they have too much to do and they can't handle it all?
Boy, that's got to be a critical factor.
It's critical.
If anything, that's got to be the factor.
The other part of this is, and my clients will often say that when they went to visit a certain place, they got a feeling, and I think parents need to always remember that they always know best. Their feelings, right, their gut instincts, right, matter a lot.
Right.
And, you know, do they see people who kind of look like their child there, or do they see children that don't? And I think that can be a big factor. But the other really important thing is parents need to understand that they're not alone in this process, that there are other people in the community, in their child's lives, that can help them. And the school districts are one of those players if your child is in school. Your child's IEP team, the teachers who are involved, the school psychologists, oftentimes know your child very well and will have suggestions for particular places that have worked well with other children. And, you know, they have the long view perspective.
Right.
They've known many students and they have known of particular residential facilities. And that can be very helpful.
That's a great resource. We've had callers that have been waiting on the line for better part of 40 minutes. So let's see if we can squeeze a couple on. We've got Alan on the line.
Hello. I emailed you last night when I saw the lineup on this program. We're people who've been protesting against wood services. Up to now, you've had 50 minutes of discussion, and the two options for people are find a residential institution or find a group home. I think after 50 years of the experts trying to sort this all out, we could have come up with some better alternatives than that. And in fact, families have come up with better alternatives than that. I don't think the context of this debate is really one that's going to benefit people with intellectual disabilities in the future. I'm a disabled person. Many of my friends are disabled people, some of whom have been in institutions and have actually come out and found out that there's a bigger life outside. I really do think that what you're doing is... And also, can I just say one thing? Very early in the show, you called blind's death an accident, and I'm not sure that the courts ruled on that yet.
Alan, you said there are alternatives to group homes and residential facilities. For example?
Well, I think, first of all, we could support families better to not have the pressure to put their children in those homes. You know, it costs $200,000 a year for Brian Nevins to be kept in their wood services, and $200,000 to any family a year would probably keep that kid in the family. Just a very simple thing, but actually just bringing more support into the families. And I think the other thing about it is that it's professionals who work in these places that are really the only people who have access to these people now. Once you go through those gates, it's very, very difficult for those people to make any contact with the community. And, you know, it's not the only time that this has happened. Things happen like this in large institutions all the time. And if people are placed inappropriately in group homes without no kind of feeling about who they're actually going to be grouped with, and there's no kind of, you know, feeling about what that group home's objective is, then yes, that would be bad too. But we know of many individuals with intellectual disabilities who are being supported in the families and are actually finding better ways to do it. Live with friends.
Alan, we have to go. As I said, we've got a ton of callers in just a few minutes, but I appreciate your email this morning, and I appreciate your calling the show with these alternatives. I want to get our experts' reaction. Susan, you were shaking your head while Alan was talking.
I think one of the things that both Dr. Levitas and Anna Hundley referred to was the need for a full range of services, and that this is not a one-size-fits-all kind of situation. I know that there are many people who would flourish without a group home setting and without any kind of campus-based setting, but there are people like my daughter who really would not, who need that level of constant supervision. And I have to disagree with your point that people don't have access to the community. At least in my own personal experience, there's constant access to the community, and it in fact is part of the curriculum to be part of the community.
Mm. Yeah, the only thing I'd like to tag on to that in response to Alan's call is that, you know, the planning for what's going to happen after the child leaves school is supposed to begin early. It's supposed to begin when the child is 14. So that discussion needs to start, you know, when your child is just starting high school. What does that child need afterwards? What's the goal? Is the goal to be independently living? Is the goal to be in college? Is the goal to be working? Every child has individual needs, and you need to start thinking about that long before the child actually leaves school.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Nat on the line. Nat, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I've been involved in what's called a LARCE community, which is an international organization. And in this organization, we have a community of faith, these homes that are communities of faith for people with and without intellectual disabilities. And so what they do is provide a different model of residential home, in which the distinction between the staff and the residents, it begins to fade away because they live together as family. And in this model, the people with disabilities are not merely seen as the recipients of care, but people who come to us really as a gift from God. And so as we live together and cook meals together and pray together and celebrate birthdays together, you just begin to be amazed by the growth that you see in these people. And so I want to lift this up as one of the other arrangements and the possibilities that we have in our society.
That's quite interesting. Tell us a little bit about what the work looks like when you work together.
Yeah, it's fairly simple. I mean, you live in the same home together. You help people wake up in the morning and shower and get dressed and eat breakfast and take their medicine. And they'll oftentimes go to day programs or to a part-time job. In the afternoon, we'll dance together or do art projects or things like that. We prepare meals in the evening to cook and pray together afterwards and then kind of just unwind and do the opposite following. And we make sure that life is fun and that these people feel celebrated as full parts of this community, and it's really gifts entrusted to us by God.
And that, spell that for us?
It's LARCH. It's LARCHE.
What's that stand for?
It stands for the Ark. It's actually in French, so it's meant to be a sign of hope in the midst of a world of chaos.
And how does someone find you?
There are 16 LARCH communities right now throughout the United States, and it's an international organization in over 130 cities throughout the world. So it's small. There aren't that many homes, but they're homes with a lot of love, and I think they're a helpful model for other group homes that already exist to mirror that encounter between what are often referred to as the residents and the staff.
Well, Nat, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
And thanks for the work you're doing. It sounds wonderful. We've got a caller who we're not going to have a chance to get to, Karen, who brings up the issue of one's relationship with a residential treatment facility. And you know, Karen alluded to it. I've heard others where a child's been lost for an hour at an outing. And you know, you want to scream and holler and raise hell. You want to bring in somebody like Josh to threaten them. But these are the people that care for your child. And my God, that's got to be a complicated relationship. Yes, Susan?
It is a complicated relationship. And I feel like my daughter has been in her placement for 7 years now, and I feel like my relationship has changed and grown a great deal. And I think that you really need to be as much a part as you can You can't drop your kid off and say, okay, these folks are going to take care of her. You need to be a presence. You need to be there. You need people to know you. And, you know, I have had things happen, particularly early in my daughter's stay there, where I was not happy and where I let it be absolutely known very clearly. But on the other hand, along with that, I really wanted them to know that I respected the work they were doing, that I supported their need for, support. And so, yeah, it's an old saw that you have to pair every smack with a compliment as well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that it doesn't have to be an adversarial relationship for it to be one of vigilance. And parents or any caregiver, I say parents, but I include grandparents or whomever is the caregiver for the child or the adult, really needs to know what the child's rights are. And they need to know that they have the right to communicate with their child. They have the right to visit. They have the right to send mail back and forth and to have telephone calls. They have the right to speak to an attorney. If you don't know what the rights are, you really don't know how to advocate. And it is, there's a big difference between being adversarial and confrontational and being vigilant. And I think everybody knows that people get better care when folks know that they're accountable. And oftentimes that means being accountable to the families.
And holding them accountable without developing an adversarial relationship requires some skill, a good deal of learning, maturity, and as Susan said, respect for the facility and devotion to your loved one at the same time. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. It's frustrating. We could go another hour at least. My guests have been Dr. Susan Epstein and Josh Kirschenbaum. Epstein works at the Center for Autism Research at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. Josh is a lawyer specializing in special needs with Frankel and Kirschenbaum. Well, next week on Voices in the Family, we'll have an author, family therapist, talking about a new book about aging families. It offers advice not just for therapists, but for families as they age throughout all the generations. Well, we are at voices@whyy.org. As you heard on today's show, we love to hear from you, and we are responsive to your questions and comments. You can reach me directly at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Sherry Siegel is our intern. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.
Tell me more.